The following is a presentation of GalacticNetcasts.com.
By your command.
Felt a great disturbance in the Force.
Resistance is futile.
Built a time machine out of a DeLorean?
Exterminate!
Silent Breed is people!
I'll be back.
That sounds like something out of science fiction.
We live in a spaceship, dear.
Hear ye, hear ye. I'm Dave Nelson, and on this 19th day of November 2014, I call to order this, the 31st meeting of the Sci-Fi Geeks Club from GalacticNetcasts.com. Our guest geek this week is a writer and podcaster. For nearly a decade, he was the editor-in-chief of Macworld and has been covering Apple and related technology since 1994. He's currently the writer, or he writes for SixColors.com, and is the host of the award-winning podcast, The Incomparable, which is also the name of his network. So welcome to the Sci-Fi Geeks Club, Mr. Jason Snell. How you doing, Jason?
Doing good. Thanks for having me. Once you win one award, you are award-winning forever.
Yeah, that would be so cool. Hey, before we continue, we have fanfare for you. Hang on. Here it is. How did that make you feel? Pretty good?
I'm
a little budget with our $2 fanfare.
I think that
we need to go downstairs and grab the trombone. Would that help?
Wow!
All right, let's introduce the co-hosts of the show: Brad Ludwig, Anessa Moyens, and Matt Stein. How you guys doing?
Good.
Doing
how are you?
Okay.
All right. As we start each show, we have we've changed the format just a bit. We've tweaked it a bit. You each used to have a different hypothetical question, but we have one hypothetical question now, and we all can kind of pile on with our own answers. So are you guys ready?
Bring it!
Yep.
All right. You're on a desert island, and you can only take one sci-fi movie with you. Which one would it be and why? Let's start with our guest, Jason Snell.
Oh, man, that's totally unfair. There are so many different ways that you could answer this question. I'm going to go with the clever way, which is to say I'm going to take Shane Carruth's cult time travel movie Primer. You might call it Primer. That's the wrong way to pronounce it, but that's fine, whatever. Only because I can watch it again and again and again, and I still have no idea what's going on. And on the desert island, I might be able to focus and watch it so many times that I finally figure out how it all connects. But I do love that movie, and I would be committed to learning everything about Primer. And even though it's not my favorite necessarily sci-fi movie, I like it. And I would use that time wisely to try to figure out the timelines.
I had a feeling that you were going to say the thing about not knowing what the hell's going on or not figuring it out, because it's a complicated piece of business.
It is. It's really. I've watched it like 5 or 6 times, and every time I watch it, I try to do the math, and about halfway through, I'm like, okay, I don't know what's going on now. And I've got the chart. I got the flow chart that's on the internet with me, and I'm just
wow.
But I figured on the desert island, I would have lots of time to think about.
Yeah, I'd say. All right. Thank you, Jason. Ladies next. Anessa, what's your movie?
I have no idea. It would be easier with the TV show.
Yeah.
Man, to be stuck on an island with one movie.
Do you want me to come back to you?
I believe Jason's pointing at the Star Trek.
I'm just pointing at the Rathacon. I mean, that's a pretty good movie. It's right here. You can take it if you like.
God! That would actually be pretty entertaining.
So is that your pick? Is that your pick, Anessa?
Actually, I kind of want to go with Idiocracy.
Oh, no, that's perfect. That's perfect. It'll make you laugh. It'll make you from not killing yourself for being alone on that desert island.
It's funny. It's entertaining. It makes fun of society as a whole, and I would be missing society, and so I guess that would kind of help me not miss it so much if I was like, yeah, it's going to crap anyway.
No, that makes sense. It makes total sense.
All right,
let's move on to our least sci-fi-ish person on the panel, Matt Stein. You're stuck on a desert island. What sci-fi movie do you bring with you?
Running Man, because Arnold Schwarzenegger.
A couple of things that you have to know about Matt there, Jason. He's a big Arnold Schwarzenegger fan. In fact, I think if you had the chance, you'd probably marry him, right?
Yeah. I mean, have you ever seen a man without a shirt on?
Arnold Schwarzenegger from the 80s, maybe.
Strong point. We just did an episode about the Terminator, and I was really appreciating how he actually does a really good job. I mean, you could joke about him selling being being robotic, but he actually does a really good job, which is important because at various points they like replace his whole head with like a fake head, and yep. and he sets it up. He actually does a really it's a great role.
Cool.
And he's Arnold Schwarzenegger.
He's a governator. What can you do?
He's also, I don't know if anyone's heard, but there's Running Man 2 is apparently potential. The movie Triplets might be a thing.
Back up the bus for a second. I'm thinking Running Man 2 being directed by Ridley Scott.
Huh?
Because Ridley Scott has nothing going on, right? He has nothing in...
Oh, he's not doing a
darn
thing.
He's just sitting around on his butt, just wasting time. Is what he's doing.
Just waiting for Running Man 2.
Yeah, he's waiting by the phone for the call from the producers to direct the movie. I'm thinking.
I can get behind that.
All right, Brad, you're last but not least, Brad Ludwig. The movie that you bring to that desert island, what is it?
They Live.
Yeah, good choice.
Nice.
That's a good one.
Yeah,
it's one of those movies where it's fun to watch. And it's not a heavy watch. I mean, you're going to be spending a lot of time gathering food and whatnot and trying to survive on this desert island. Why not have a movie that you can play and come back to at any point and go, oh, yeah, I know where I am.
Mm-hmm. You have to break to battle the killer monkeys that are attacking you. You have to take a break to actually find food to survive. So I could see where that would come in handy, definitely.
I think it would be... Yes?
Anessa?
Oh, no. I was going to ask what Dave's movie would be.
God. You know what? I want to take the easy way out and go with Jason's poster, Star Trek II: The Wrath of Khan.
Hey!
Yeah. Definitely could watch that over and over again, and I have. It's my favorite Star Trek movie.
You're still alive.
Ricardo Montalban is just so over the top. He was the best. He was the best villain.
From hell's heart, I stab at thee.
His chest was like crazy smooth and distracting. It was weird.
I just wanted him to like whip out some Corinthian leather and put it on the captain's chair. Boom.
You know he would have. He would have gotten there if they had survived and taken the, you know, because that's you know that's what his second in command. He's like, sir, we got a ship. Let's get out of here. And he's like, no, I must kill Kirk. And it's like, you know, we could get some Corinthian leather. We could tool around the galaxy, but sadly, not to be.
You know what?
Get some more chest waxing done.
They could do an alternate universe version of you know, what happened? What would have happened if he would have survived? Because, of course, they're doing the alternate universe with the new Star Trek movie. So why not do it with another alternate universe with Ricardo Montalban?
We can dream.
Yeah, that's all we can do right now. All right, thank you very much, guys. Let's start off the show with a little section that we call Sci-Fi Bites. These are just quick headlines. You can comment on them if you want. You don't have to if you don't want to. So, HBO officially announces the Westworld series based on Michael Crichton's hit book and cult movie from the 70s, set to star Sir Anthony Hopkins and Ed Harris. The network describes the show as a dark odyssey about the dawn of artificial consciousness and the future of sin. What do you guys, how do you feel about this?
Well, I've not seen the 70s movie. So I'll be interested to see it as a TV show.
Yeah, I remember seeing part of the movie, but not all of it. So I'm kind of interested to see what happened. And yeah, they announced it with a video.
Yeah. Really creepy video.
Yeah, I'm kind of interested. I've been hearing about it, but I haven't seen it yet. So I want to watch that clip and see what it's all about.
I think HBO's definitely the right place for this. And isn't Christopher Nolan's brother producing it or directing the first episode?
I think
some kind of involvement, right?
There's a Nolan in there somewhere.
Probably.
Jason, have you seen the original Westworld?
Yeah, it's Yeah. It's Yul Brynner as the robot gunfighter. It's actually pretty cool. I think Jonathan Nolan wrote the pilot, and this is also a J.J. Abrams production too. So I think it's interesting. HBO is loading up on this stuff. I think this is finally we're seeing the Game of Thrones factor here, where they're like, what other properties can we take and do like large scale genre kind of shows? So they're also doing a show based on the Margaret Atwood trilogy, the Mad Adam trilogy. I don't know if you've read any of those books.
Yeah.
Really pretty good books. And they're, Darren Aronofsky is involved. It's crazy. There's some crazy stuff going on.
And they're going to, you got a story about another one coming up later on in the show, right?
Yeah, I think I saw that. Yeah. Yeah. There's a lot going on. There's a lot of crazy sci-fi TV happening right now.
Yeah. Sci-fi's got some great stuff coming on too. So I think we're at the dawn of a new era of science fiction on TV.
Yep, I agree.
All right, Doctor Who showrunner confirms Peter Capaldi returning for season 9.
Shocker!
Yeah.
Bum, bum,
bum. Now, the big question is, Clara Oswald, not sure if she's coming back. There's rumors going around that she may leave after the Christmas special. So I know that Anessa is pulling for that to happen.
I really hope so. I'm done with her.
I feel like her story has sort of been told. I like Jenna Coleman. I think I've enjoyed her character over the last year and a half, and especially this year, I felt like they did a lot more with her. But at the same time, I'm not sure where she goes from here. She's kind of proven herself, and I could see her maybe coming back for half a year next year. But I wouldn't be surprised if this is the end. It seems like they've reached an ending for her, or very close to it.
Yeah, I think they've reached a good point to kind of tie the final knot, I suppose, in the Christmas special, and then just move on to the next companion. And I do think that there needs to be a new companion, not just because, you know, like, I enjoyed Clara, but I think they spent a lot more time on her than they did with the new Doctor. To me, I think they could have given Capaldi a bit more camera time, more storyline, rather than her coming to terms with him being the Doctor. And like, I want him to be able to shine more as the Doctor and a little less focus on the companions.
And he does such a good job, too. I can't wait for more Peter Capaldi, that's for sure. All right, second to last sci-fi bite here. The new Universal Monster movies will be taken out of the horror genre. Basically, they're doing a comic book universe treatment on the classic Universal Monsters, like the werewolf and Dracula, right? Who else? Mm-hmm. The invisible
Frankenstein,
the Invisible Man, mm-hmm. and Creature from the Black Lagoon, I believe, is also on that list.
Wow. Yep.
So basically, they're going to be set in modern day, and they're going to be less horror and more action. So how do you guys feel about that?
Together, they're the Avengers, half monster, half Avenger. All something. I don't even. Isn't that weird? Isn't that a weird idea? I guess the Avengers, you make $1 billion and everybody else is like, oh, I want $1 billion. What do we have?
Yeah. Well, you can kind of tell there's the Avengers effect with the whole DC trying to catch up with Marvel. And now Everybody's like, I heard that there's going to be a Robin Hood type, like, shared universe deal that's going to be made. I think it's the dawn of the shared universe world now, I guess.
Who is Robin Hood sharing his universe with?
I don't know. I have no idea. I guess we're going to find out. All right. And finally, Glenn A. Larson passes away on Saturday after a long battle with cancer. Of course, he had his hands in a lot of TV shows. Battlestar Galactica, the original one. And Buck Rogers in the 25th Century, Knight Rider, $6 Million Man, and Magnum P.I. He was a great guy.
Basically, if you watched a show in the 80s, you probably watched one of his.
Yep.
Yeah, I grew up on his shows, and like Knight Rider was an obsession, a Friday night obsession for me as a kid. Magnum P.I., I would argue, is still like up there with the Rockford Files as one of the best action-adventure TV shows ever made, certainly from that era, the classic TV era, before there was continuity and story arcs and things like that. And, you know, if you've ever learned anything about Mormonism, you might be baffled by the fact that Battlestar Galactica's entire, like, all of the words they use are based on things that are in Mormon religion, and it's because of Glenn Larson, because he was a Mormon, and so he stuck all of the Mormon like terms get dropped into Battlestar Galactica. It's a really interesting thing that he did when he was building the sort of, you know, doing the world building of Battlestar Galactica.
So frack is a Mormon word?
You'd have to ask, ask a Mormon friend if they felt frack and Feldekarb are actually Mormon or not.
I had no idea.
But like Kobol and
yeah,
or a bunch of those terms that are right out of Book of Mormon and
yeah, the terms and some of the concepts and whatnot.
Yeah.
I did not know that, and I thought it was cool how Sci-Fi brought him on as a consultant producer in the rebooted version of the show. That was pretty awesome that they. I suppose they probably had to do that though, right? He had some kind of rights to the property, right? Mm-hmm. I think
that's probably right.
Okay,
but you know, that was, I think he was happy that his concepts were coming back to life. I mean, the knock on him always was that he did knockoffs of other shows. So Star Wars was big, and so he's like, all right, I can get you Battlestar Galactica, I can get you Buck Rogers, I can slide these in here and take advantage of Star Wars being popular. And that was always, you know, he was accused of not being very creative and being more a knockoff artist. And I think the remake of Galactica validated him in a way, because mm-hmm. it showed that there were core concepts in there that could become something modern and great, and that that meant there was more to it than just like a Xerox of Star Wars.
All right. Yeah. Thank you, Jason. And that does it for Sci-Fi Bites. Let's get into our discussion stories this week. And we've been sitting with this story in our document for 3 weeks now, because Matt's been off running around doing who knows what, and we've been teased by this headline for 3 weeks. So, Matt, please finally reveal what you're going to talk about this week.
DARPA has funded researchers have created a drone that can learn. And the reason this was originally picked 3 weeks ago is because I was in the middle of a book, very similar concept, called Kill Decision by Daniel Suarez. So DARPA's funded this drone, and basically what it is it's, you know, a plane that flies around, and it has 576 silicon neurons that were on the initial prototype, and it can fly into rooms and it kind of sees what's around, and it can tell when it goes into a different room, and it creates like a map. So the description that it has is, it says, the first time the drone was flown into each room, the unique pattern of incoming sensor data from the walls, furniture, and other objects caused a pattern of electrical activity in the neurons that the chip had never experienced before. So it triggered it to report that it was in a new space, and also caused the ways the neurons connected to one another to change. So it's basically, it's a crude mimic of an actual human brain, which is kind of cool. I guess it depends on where it goes from here. And why I got initially really interested in this is, like I said, I was reading that book. And in the book, there's a researcher who's doing research on weaver ants and their swarming techniques. And basically, terrorists have stolen the programming for the weaver ant models and imported it into these drones. And these drones are attacking these people that they say, go find these people. And these drones basically go and kill these people on their own. So it was crazy timing, to say the least, that this was such a far-fetched idea when I started the book, that, like, you're just going to create this drone and it's going to basically go do whatever. You know, it can fly around, it can see stuff, and it can make a decision on where it is and what it can do. And now DARPA is actually funding it, which is scary. I mean, I know we've talked about Amazon drones and them delivering stuff and the concept of something just kind of showing up, just flying, whether it's, you know, human-operated or just knows where to go. It's kind of scary, the technology that we have, and this is just another realization of what they can come up with given time.
And of course, we always make that Skynet joke, right?
Yes, it's just one step closer to being so overrun with technology that you can't control it.
So what do you guys think is going to happen to stop the development of drones, because they seem like there's a leap forward in drone technology all the time? Do you think there's going to be an incident that happens? Like, I was watching an episode of Chicago Fire, and a kid that was flying a drone hit the propeller of a helicopter, causing the helicopter to crash. And that seems like something that might stop the popularity or the development of drones. What do you guys think?
something really bad is going to have to happen for it to stop. And it's going to have to happen to someone notable. So if a drone... But you laugh, Brad, but, I mean, unless a drone accidentally kills someone really famous and it becomes very noticeable to the public, I don't think anything is going to stop it.
Or maybe a, like, U.S. military drone accidentally, like, firing on... Well, maybe not friendly fire, but maybe the wrong enemy, like the...
Mm-hmm.
Like no, Iran, you know, maybe an Iranian target by accident.
And so touching back on the book Kill Decision, the main concept was that all these drones that could go and find and kill them, kill someone, there was always a human who had the kill decision. So it would confirm its target and a person would have to say, yes, that's who you need to kill. So they could go that route where there's always a human being always gets the last say. But do you have to assume that someone's going to, you know...
Pay attention?
Yeah, someone's got to pay attention to make that decision. Technology goes wrong every day. You know, things break, things crash, things go haywire. You can't tell me that a drone can't do the same thing. It's just a different piece of technology than a computer. Not even, it is a computer.
Yeah.
So,
Brad, Jason, your thoughts on this?
Wow. It just seems like... It seems like a dangerous first step, and it creeps me out.
Well, it's the public, it's the first step in the public eyes. So you don't know what they've done prior to actually admitting that this was happening.
It's very true.
Yeah, you laugh at me, but you know I'm right.
I don't know whether I'm being optimistic or pessimistic. I think that the drones are going to be with us in all forms from here on out, and that's going to be an interesting challenge. I'm actually reading William Gibson's new book, The Peripheral, which has a whole lot of drones. And I think they're going to be around. For something like a weaponized drone, one would hope that the self-navigation and all of that will be possibly remote-controlled, but that... you know, when it comes time to arm the weapon systems, that there's a human being making those decisions. Because I think that's ultimately the most terrifying thought about this, is that you're going to have a drone that just decides when to kill people. And that what could go wrong, as our notes point out, how could that be bad for a robot drone to kill everybody? But, you know, I don't know. They're not going away. I feel like this is one of those technologies that we need rules, and we need to, you know, we need to know what they're allowed to do and what they're not allowed to do. And the military applications of it are the scary part, where it gets to the point where there should really be a person in the chain of command who's saying, yes, we're going to drop this bomb. Yes, we're going to fire this gun. That's the part that I think is the most important.
Yeah, the two scary parts, number one is self-aware drones eventually. And number two is too many drones in the sky causing accidents. So there's got to be some kind of regulations. Sure. They got to put something together, because they're permeating the skies of America and the world right now. All right, let's move on. We got a second DARPA story. What the hell? Brad, explain yourself.
Well, I just saw this today, and this story comes from Gizmodo. And there was an interview with the DARPA director. And there was the question posed, okay, we've got Google and we've got other companies that have purchased other robotics R&D-based companies. Are you threatened by that? And the response to this was really, really interesting. So Google had purchased Boston Dynamics, but then they vowed to exit the military robotics market. And the interviewer... who was his name? Patrick Tucker asked Prabhakar. Arati Prabhakar, and I'm totally probably massacring that name, and I apologize. Asked him if they were worried about an innovation gap with Google, and kind of jokingly wondered if Google was DARPA's frenemy. And what's interesting is the response is he seemed to kind of be like, what are you talking about? That's complete crap. They're not adversaries. And his response was, national security is not really about us versus a private company. They're not an adversary. They and we are worried about the problems of the world. They're going to try and make money on it. That's what they do as a private company. and we're going to try to deal with it from a perspective of national interests. I want to harvest what they and many, many others are investing in and driving technology forward, which makes a lot of sense. That's kind of been their MO all along.
As long as they can make money off the advertising, then they're happy.
They said that a third of spending on research and development in the U.S. is currently coming from the government, and two-thirds is coming from the private sector. In the years after World War II, that ratio flipped, and now two-thirds of R&D spending comes from the government and one-third from private sources. If you look at the percentage of GDP, the private sector investment in R&D has just grown and grown and grown over many, many decades. That is the innovation economy that we're all living in. DARPA has always used contractors to develop groundbreaking technologies, but they clearly lean on private enterprise to spur technological advancement now more than ever. When we invested in technology, DARPA could do that with the confidence that we've had, 10, 20, maybe 30 years of technological advantage over the other party. That is not the world we live in today. I went on to explain that this is a fantastic development, but that DARPA was well aware that these technologies were not being developed solely by U.S. companies for an American market. She went on to refer to the globalization challenge that DARPA now faces in staying ahead of military adversaries. So, we've got a lot going on. DARPA's always been the military branch of R&D in technology, and it's kind of interesting to see the symphony that seems to happen between government and private enterprise to try to innovate and make new technologies that do have military applications.
Well, it's happening also with NASA, right? With all the private space companies. You got your SpaceX, you got your, what's the other one that they're working with? The one that just had the accident, not Virgin Galactic, but the Antares spacecraft?
Yeah. Yep.
Who's that again? The company? You guys know?
No, that was the Antares rocket, I think, was the...
Yeah, but what's the company name?
Orbital Sciences?
Yeah, Orbital Sciences. There, it was Orbital Sciences, it was SpaceX, and it was one of the old school contractors that got the
Boeing.
Big contract.
Boeing,
yeah. Yeah. So it's not just happening with the military, it's also happening with NASA. I mean, they're doing what everybody else is doing. They're doing what all the private industry is doing as well, as far as innovation. They're they have to compete, so they have to bring private companies in.
They really do. So, I guess we can't be looking at it as solely, the government has to develop everything, and that's just how that happens for military application. It is a process where everybody kind of works together to make something bigger and better, and hopefully we don't accidentally create Skynet. So.
Yeah, hopefully. Let's keep our fingers crossed. Now let's go from a story – we talk about DARPA all the time on this show. So let's go from a story about technology inspired by science fiction to science fiction tropes that we hope that is not inspired to actually come to reality, I guess. I got this article from io9.com, 10 science fiction tropes, or it says 10, but I'm only going to mention a few of them. Science fiction tropes that we hope that we never get tired of. So basically, these are classic tropes from science fiction movies and TV shows that you always see. And there's 10 in this article, but I'm going to only mention just a few of them. So let's start with my favorite on this list. Gigantic clear tubes. You see them all over the place. They're multifunctional. Medical healing, space travel, intergalactic hibernation, cybergenic freezing. Movies that we've seen them in: Independence Day, Event Horizon, Star Wars, Minority Report, Night of the Creeps. I'm not sure if I'm familiar with that one. You guys
Night of the Creeps. Actually, that was a review that I did on the alien invasion.
Really?
Yes.
Okay. What's it about?
It's about basically little worms that infest a person and then take over their bodies and
Okay.
That kind of a film.
Do you remember the big plastic tubes?
Yes, actually, there was Like a whole mess of them in one sort of a glass tube.
Okay.
If I recall.
Okay. All right.
You know, the season finale of Doctor Who just had big clear tubes. The whole place where the skeletons are that turn into something else, if you haven't seen it. That's a whole building full of nothing but clear tubes.
That's right. It's so funny. Once you realize it's a trope, you see it all over the place. Like, you don't realize it until somebody points it out. Oh, gigantic clear tubes. Yep. Seen it.
Yep.
All right. So next on this list is fun robes. I love this one, too. So we've become so accustomed to the wondrous world of futuristic robe wearing that seeing any sort of future god or alien political group in pants just looks laughable. So how do you know if the person's being respected? Well, they're wearing a robe, right? It's a robe, so you better bow. That's what, according to this article. Seen in Prometheus, was it the engineers that were the ones?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep.
He looked comfortable until they woke him up. Feel sorry for that guy. Logan's Run, Beneath the Planet of the Apes, Tron Legacy, and of course, Star Wars, made most famous for... was it a robe or was it more of a... I don't know what you would call that, what they were wearing on Star... I guess they could be a robe, right?
Yeah, the Jedi have... They've got their robes.
Yeah.
They're walking around in.
Okay.
I would like to add in jumpsuits here because I feel like the gray jumpsuit doesn't get enough credit. One of the ways you can tell you're in the future or somebody is an alien is there's a jumpsuit involved, usually gray. Right, because it's like we're from a strange future where color doesn't exist.
Yep.
That happens a lot, too. So robes, jumpsuits, those are both great.
Okay, good point. Thank you, Jason. How about futuristic product placement? In movies like Back to the Future, you had Mr. Fusion. You had that futuristic Jaws 3D marquee that kind of jumped out at Marty and freaked him out, right? And then Fancy Pepsi. My favorite, it's in this article, is J.J. Abrams, the bar scene from the 2009 Star Trek when Uhura ordered the Budweiser Classic, right?
Yeah. Yeah, although also J.J. Abrams' fake product placement, he's had, there's something called Slusho that appears in all of his movies.
Too. Yes.
Uhura orders a Slusho in Star Trek along with the Budweiser Classic.
I forgot about that. That's originally from Lost, right? Or does it go way before that?
Well, it appeared in Lost, and then it appeared in...
it's in Cloverfield.
Cloverfield, yep.
And I think they've actually made reference on Once Upon a Time, even though that's not a J.J. Abrams... That's not a Bad Robot production, but the producers from Lost are doing Once Upon a Time, so I believe they threw that in as well.
I believe it's in Alias.
Yeah,
that's
it's
where
in
it
Alias, yeah.
Okay. Yep. That's awesome. I like those continuing things like that.
So that's fake product placement. But Back to the Future, I feel like Back to the Future 2 is like ground zero for product placement in the future, right? That there is so much product placement in Back to the Future 2. And it's great and hilarious and weird.
They set the standard, I think, Back to the Future 2, definitely. How about this? Elaborate post-apocalyptic gangs.
Yep.
And I have to read this because this is the best part of it. The best thing about any type of film set in a gang-ruled future are the elaborate ensembles. Where do they find these outfits? Why are football pads and mohawks good for the desert, but not sunglasses or hats? Where is everyone finding the proper tools for face painting and or face tattoos?
Well, you know, face painting is pretty easy. All they need to do is find a flower or something, smash it up, and then smear stuff on their face. Or even just mud. Mud and spit. Just dirt and spit. Pet.
That doesn't sound very futuristic badass.
Matt.
No, but it looks great with the shoulder pads.
Matt,
I like the uniformity thing. It's like, how in the apocalypse could you manage to find 15 of anything? But they're like, I don't know, the high school had some shoulder pads over here for the football team. We thought they were cool. And there was like a bear that tried to get us and it hit the shoulder pads. We thought everybody should have shoulder pads. I don't know.
Yeah.
Matt, wasn't there futuristic gangs in Demolition Man? What's the... Schwarzenegger film that you mentioned earlier?
In Running Man?
Running Man.
Running Man?
Wasn't there gangs in that film? or just a lot of weird futuristic outfits?
Yeah, well, okay, so the outfits are worn by, like, the I don't even know what you want to call them. The skin-tight suits are worn by the contestants on the show, and then the... What, Brad?
Go ahead.
There's weird suits worn by, and the word escapes me, which makes me a terrible human being, but, like, the badasses that are sent in to kill.
Okay.
So they each have their own. So, like, Sub-Zero is an ice guy, so he comes in, like, a full goalie hockey getup, and like, the fire guy, there's an electric guy who has, like, lights running around his back and all this stuff. So that's where the crazy suits come in. But when you mentioned this, the first movie I thought of was Johnny Mnemonic.
Yeah.
Because there's a gang in that movie called the Low-Techs that are led by Ice-T. And they're, like, wearing, like, these big, long trench coats and all this crazy stuff, and they're supposed to look, like, old school.
What was that film from the 1970s? It was all about gangs.
The Warriors.
The Warriors, yeah. Mm-hmm. I think speaking of setting the tone, I think that movie set the tone for futuristic gangs.
Probably.
Very much so.
All right.
And I was thinking of one other film, too. Escape from New York?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
Escape from LA.
Yep.
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 I choose to believe that Escape from LA doesn't exist.
I think I saw Escape from LA first, but I was also like 7.
Yeah, you're of a different generation, Matt. So
back in my day, we enjoyed futuristic gang films like The Warriors and Escape from New York.
Well, hey, I like the movie The Warriors.
Matt's generation likes the prequels, the Star Wars prequels, more than the original three. So,
hey, Matt, would you say you can dig it?
I can dig it. We can dig it. Can you dig it?
Can you dig it?
I agree with Dave on the Star Wars thing.
What?
Maybe they're just being a hipster. Well, because Dave said that Matt's generation is more inclined to, like...
Do not lump me in with those of my age group.
I know, but, I mean, I worked in a university. I encountered, like, younger people than...
The youth!
...myself. And the ones that, you know, talked about Star Wars always talked about the originals.
Really? Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, maybe you're right.
And, I mean, they would mention the newer prequels, but they favored the originals.
Well, maybe it's an even younger generation than that, because when did the prequels come out? The first one came out in 99.
The first one came out in like 99.
Okay. Yep. So maybe they're not quite to college age yet. The ones that really kind of grew up with those prequels.
Cuz I went and I saw the prequels. Well, I went and saw the first one in 99, and I waited in a ridiculously long line to see it. But, I mean, I had grown up watching the originals and the various spin-off cartoons that came from it. But, yeah, I mean, you would probably have to get people that were born in the mid to late 90s.
Okay. All right, that makes sense.
Have them. And even then, like, it's really difficult to say, because then you might have their parents be like, you need to watch, you know, the original one.
Well, let's hope. Let's hope they had some smart parents.
Don't watch The Phantom Menace.
Let's hope they had some smart parents.
You're grounded. You watch The Phantom Menace. You never know. Like, you really never know.
Yeah.
But yeah, as far as, like, my encounter with people and talking about Star Wars, they seem to acknowledge more the original three than the prequels.
All right. Okay. Okay, one final trope that we hope never goes away, and I made mention this earlier, futuristic slang. For example, BSG, frack, instead of the normal F word, which I'm not going to say, because I don't want to have to go back in and bleep it out when I do the editing of this podcast.
You could, and just keep a mental
podcast editor right there, yeah.
Dave, that is a white person problem. I don't want to have to go back and edit my swearing out of my internet radio show.
You don't realize, and Jason will back me up on this, it's hard to find that one spot where that one thing happened that you have to edit out.
Well, you got to write the time code down. I do that every time somebody swears on my show. I'm like, all right, 18 minutes, 23 seconds, there's that, okay. I just keep a running tally of everything terrible that everybody says. And...
That's what I'm doing wrong. I need to put a notepad and a pen next to my computer.
So yeah, my favorite show with futuristic swearing is Farscape, which has lots of it, including Frel, which is the frack of Farscape.
What is it?
But they're Frel.
Frel.
Yeah, okay.
And there are many more. Dren. I at one point I looked it up. There's like 8 different swear words that they made up for Farscape. Yeah.
They're going way overboard on that. Holy crap.
Yeah,
okay.
Red Dwarf only did Smeg.
Yeah.
Well, I think frack has really taken off. Like, you hear that in very much non-science fiction, like I hear it on show, like comedy shows, and just like normal life, people say frack. That's permeated society more than any other one, I believe.
I think because it sounds a lot like the F-bomb. Mm-hmm. It's 4 letters, begins with an F,
yep.
Ends with a K.
Yep, yep.
It's short, people will get the point, whereas if, you know, you start tossing out, like, Red Dwarfs, Smeg, they're going to be like, what? So at least it sounds close enough, and it's not just using, like, freaking or whatever other substitute for the F word is. So
you're right.
Shorten to the point and people pick up on what you're trying to say.
Firefly, of course, had the English Chinese mashups as their
Shiny's
another one that a lot of people use, or you hear it mentioned like as an homage to Firefly once in a while in other shows.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. All right. So if you want to get more of these tropes that we don't want to go away out of our sci-fi, check out the link in the show notes to the podcast, and you can get the whole list courtesy of io9.com. All right. Let's move on to Anessa. Anessa, what you got there?
Another new science fiction magazine has just joined the internet.
Whoa.
Vice Magazine, which is already writing about science fiction via its motherboard website, has launched a sci-fi magazine called Terraform with stories by Cory Doctorow and Bruce Sterling.
Oh, Cory's great.
The interesting part.
Cory's great. He's from boingboing.net.
Ah. But the interesting part is they want more fiction to go viral. And so Terraform is going to post new stories every week to a number of other web magazines. And just like Tor.com and some other online publishers, they'll mingle their fiction output with the articles and stuff on Motherboard. But their launch essay makes a point of saying that they hope that these short fiction pieces make it onto social media in a way that short fiction all too seldom does. How are they going to do this? By, quote, seizing and playing upon or off the zeitgeist. So if everybody is already freaking out about drones, they'll publish a story that has to do with drones and become part of the conversation. This is a tremendously ambitious idea, one that would presumably require having a lot of stories and inventory waiting for the right news cycle. But if it works, it could make science fiction part of our discussion of technology and science in a new way. So I thought that was kind of cool.
That is awesome. Because, you know, videos are popular. GIFs are popular. What else? Funny memes are popular. So why not make science fiction short stories popular as well?
Could even have one about memes or something.
Yeah.
How memes are created by aliens to control the population's mindset or something, or to distract the population from what's actually going on with cat videos during their alien invasion.
And
quick, somebody write that.
And you know what? This may get more people to read, too. If it's something that people are interested in, and if the short stories are short enough, if they're digestible, then I think it might get people to sit down and read a story once more than they do currently.
Yep. Yeah, I think it's a good idea. It's a nice approach that they have to trying to get more stories out there and onto social media and read. So hopefully their plan works. Fingers crossed.
Yeah,
I love the idea of treating sci-fi as like science fiction as news is such a great idea, because that it can be so topical. It can speak to modern issues. And, you know, I think Vice is a great platform to reach a lot of interesting people with that kind of speculation. So it's an awesome, awesome story. Yeah.
I had an idea for a podcast a couple of years ago. I never implemented, but it was an idea for a while to sci-fi the news, like take a news story and just maybe have a couple of people and just sitting around, like, kind of spitballing, how would you make a new story but put a sci-fi angle on it? Like, snowstorm in New York. Maybe it's not caused by lake effect. Maybe it's caused by aliens, that kind of thing. So it's kind of goes along with what I was wanting to do but never did. Damn it.
That's a great idea.
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe Jason and I should do a podcast together, and we can do that.
Yeah, see, what you do is you take all the snow from the lake effect and you bottle it, like, in giant trucks and send it to California because we have no water here.
Yeah. So there's quite the disparity between every other part in the world and California right now, it seems. As far
we're
as
we're all going to die, but we're going to be comfortable doing it.
Yeah. All right. Have any of you guys read anything off Tor before?
Yeah, I've read some stuff from Tor, and I think I've used a couple of the short stories that I found on there as picks before in the Alien Invasion.
I went on the site this week. I don't know why, but I went on the site. And I'm like, why haven't I been here before? I should totally visit this website more often.
Oh, I really like Tor.com.
They got good news, and then I think like half the Hugo-nominated short fiction last year was from Tor.com. It's kind of amazing.
Oh, wow. That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So check that out. What's the website called? Or it's a magazine. It's an online magazine.
The magazine is it's put out by Vice, but it's going to be Terraform.
Okay. All right. And we'll have the link, of course, in the show notes of the podcast. You can check it out for yourself.
Yeah, if you just go to motherboard.vice.com/terraform.
All right, cool. Thank you, Anessa. Let's stay on the subject of written science fiction with Jason's story.
Rolling Stone did an article that was an interview with William Gibson. And like I mentioned earlier, William Gibson's new novel, The Peripheral, is out. You may remember him as the guy who wrote Neuromancer. I think his actually last trilogy of books that he wrote that The Peripheral doesn't count in. It's beginning of, I don't know if it's a new series or if it's just a standalone book. The previous trilogy I thought was fantastic. I think it's actually his best work. And that comes from somebody who loves Neuromancer. Anyway, The Peripheral is out. It's weird. It's interesting. I'm only about halfway through it. It took me about 20% into it on my Kindle before I figured out what the heck was even going on. It's one of those. But Rolling Stone did an interview with him, and it's an interesting interview. He's an interesting guy. It's worth reading it. But what I wanted to mention was just more like that you could literally make a drinking game out of William Gibson interviews, because everybody is going from the same notes, and I feel like I've read this interview over the last 20 years, and it's never any different. It's, you know, your father died when you were young. How did that affect you? You grew up in Virginia, but now you live in Canada. How did you get to Canada? What's Vancouver like? You know, did you take LSD? I can't believe you didn't see a computer before you wrote Neuromancer. Is that true? And it's like, yep. It's all in there. It's all in that Rolling Stone article. It's good. And I love William Gibson. I think he's a really great writer. He's one of my favorites. But I wish mainstream media would do a better job of interviewing sci-fi authors in general, because I feel like by following William Gibson's career, I've unwittingly exposed the playbook of how you interview a sci-fi writer, because I've been paying close enough attention to realize they always ask him the exact same questions. It's like, it's too bad, because there are probably big picture things that you could ask somebody that smart that don't tend to come out in something like a Rolling Stone interview.
Don't you think, though, that the reason they ask these questions is because they want to kind of dumb it down for mainstream consumers?
I just don't see why asking about him growing up in Virginia before he moved to Canada and about his father dying when he was young is like really covering. I mean, yeah, it's not. You could cover new. It's not covering new ground. You're like trying to recap for people, but it's like, well, you got somebody there who's thinking about the future and talking about the future. Perhaps you should talk to him about those things a little bit more and not retread sort of like how he came to be here, because that's really boring. But he's an interesting guy, and the stories are fascinating. The fact that he did write Neuromancer on a manual typewriter, it just kind of blows me away. And yeah, if you haven't read Pattern Recognition, which was from 2003. The start of that sort of latter day trilogy that he did, I highly recommend it. It is a fantastic book.
I've always been a little intimidated by his books. I've never read any of his stories. Is he a pretty easy read, or is it pretty complicated?
In general, I would say he is. I would say he's not a you know, you could argue like Neuromancer. I mean, Neuromancer is a pulp story. It's not highfalutin in any way. It's legendary. I mean, he's a very stylish writer, but it's not in an impenetrable literary way, I would say. He's writing, many of his books are really just, they're like noir detective stories, except set with bizarre technological twists. And even Neuromancer, which is about AI and it's about virtual reality, is really like not that different from a Raymond Chandler novel in some ways. The plot wise, it's not that different. And pattern recognition, I think these days I would recommend to more people as being a more accessible place to go, because it's basically set in the, it's not quite the present, but it's very close to the present with tech added, you know, advanced a little bit. And it's really smart and good stuff. So I think I love him. I think he's a great writer, and I don't think he's an impenetrable literary figure. I don't think those are the kinds of stories that he writes.
Did he write Snow Crash? Is that his?
No, that's Neal Stephenson, okay. Who is different, similar, but different. William Gibson doesn't write as long as Neal Stephenson, and he's better at sticking the ending than Neal Stephenson is. And I like Neal Stephenson, but Gibson's absolutely a better writer than Stephenson is. Stephenson at his best is as good as Gibson at his best, I would say. But I think Gibson's at his best more than Stephenson is.
Brad, just gauging your laughter, have you read his stuff?
I've read Gibson's stuff, yes. Okay. And I know of the large volumes that Stephenson puts out.
thousands
Stephenson
of
did
pages.
Like, yeah, they're massive doorstops. But don't get me wrong, from my friends that I have friends that are trying to get me to read Stephenson. I just can't make that kind of, you know, thousand plus page commitment to his stuff. But like Cryptonomicon gets great reviews.
Yeah. Read the Diamond Age. The Diamond Age is actually really good, and it's one of his earlier books, so it's not a billion pages long. Okay. And Zodiac, which is actually one of his first novels, is also great and actually set in the present day for 1988. But Zodiac is really great, and Diamond Age is a really nice bit of sci-fi from him before he started. Every novel had to be like contractually more than 1,000 pages. Novels are good, but oh my god, they are so long.
You get pigeonholed into one type of thing, and you have to make a 1,000-page book every single time.
Well, the problem was that he did the Baroque cycle, which is 3,000-page books.
Holy crap!
And it's telling one story, and it's pretty good, but oh my god, it is, yeah. And Cryptonomicon is good; it's 900 pages. Anathem is good; it's like 1,200 pages. It's not that these books are bad, but they're so, you're making such a commitment to go into them that it's pretty scary. So I recommend for Stephenson, I recommend Snow Crash, and for Gibson, I recommend what did I say? Pattern recognition. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Cool.
Okay.
Great.
There's
recommendations.
Your book recommendations.
All right. Thank you very much, sir. All right. That's going to pretty much do it for this edition of the Sci-Fi Geeks Club. You can find out more by going to galacticnetcasts.com. All the links are there for our social feeds, for our subscriptions. You can also just jump on iTunes, Stitcher, and TuneIn Radio. We're on all three platforms there. Just search for either the Sci-Fi Geeks Club or Galactic Netcasts. Leave us feedback by emailing galacticnetcasts@gmail.com or call our voicemail number or leave a text message as well, 805-328-3966. All right, Jason Snell, thank you very much for being our guest on this edition of the Sci-Fi Geeks Club, sir.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you.
Where can people find your stuff, and what kind of thing do you want to push here?
Well, I think given the subject matter here, I would love people to come visit theincomparable.com, and we've got lots of shows. We got the main podcast. We got a Star Trek podcast that's a lot of fun. We got a Dungeons & Dragons podcast. There's a lot there, so check that out, and you can also reach me on Twitter at jsnell.
All right. Thank you, Jason, and thank you to the panel, Matt, Brad, and Nessa. Good to have the whole crew back together again. Matt, don't be taken off for weeks at a time again, please.
Yell at work.
We missed you, Matthew.
I missed you guys too.
Although I think on the next episode you're not going to be here because we're doing it Thursday. If we can work around your soccer schedule.
Sorry, I like to try and remain active and work all the time.
We are taking the week off for Thanksgiving, but we'll be back the first week of December with Justin Robert Young from Weird Things Podcast and The Night Attack Show. So that ought to be interesting. He's an interesting character, and can't wait to be talking to him on the next edition of the Sci-Fi Geese Club. Until then, I call this meeting adjourned. Hang on. I got to find the... Here it is. All right, we'll talk to you guys next time.
Bye.
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 Bye, Dad.
You have been listening to a presentation of GalacticNetcasts.com. For more about the show you just listened to, including how to subscribe, give us feedback, links to our social feeds, and more, please visit www.GalacticNetcasts.com.